Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Cheryl Strayed, author of several books, including her best-selling memoir, Wild, as well as Tiny Beautiful Things, Brave Enough, and the novel Torch. Ms. Strayed's remarks were given as the second annual Marion Marsh Brown Writers Lecture, presented annually by Marion's family, Paul and Jelan Brown, and their children, Randy, Scott, and Marietta Llewellyn. Marion Marsh Brown served as a professor of English at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, then Omaha University, from 1954 to 1968. She wrote more than 15 books and is best known for her young adult literature. The series celebrates her life and work by bringing a well-known author to UNO each year. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 27, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Gail Baker, Dean of the College of Communication, Fine Arts, and Media at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Thank you for joining us for the second annual Marion Marsh Brown Writers Lecture. The purpose of this series is to celebrate the joy of reading, and to that end, we are certainly in for a treat. An evening with an author whom the New York Times described as uplifting, fierce, and funny. We are pleased to be able to welcome Cheryl Strayed to Omaha and to our campus tonight. On behalf of UNO, I would like to extend our gratitude to Cheryl for being here, and also to Paul and Jelan Brown, who are generously sponsoring this yearly lecture series. Tonight's program is titled A Wild Life. I can't think of anything more fitting. Cheryl Strayed's readers know that she has seen more than her fair share of adventure, heartbreak, love, and loss. Her memoir, Wild, chronicling her soul-searching trek after the loss of her mother, climbed to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. It was followed by two more bestsellers, Tiny Beautiful Things and Brave Enough. Starting with her debut novel, Torch, Cheryl's writing has been consistently praised for its honesty, intimacy, and warmth. She grapples with the big ideas that can keep you up late at night, tackling themes of grief, hope, and purpose with clarity and candor. In 2012, Cheryl's story drew the attention of none other than Oprah Winfrey, who selected Wild for the first book in Oprah's Book Club 2.0. 2 years later, an Oscar-nominated film adaptation of Wild hit theaters, starring Reese Witherspoon as Cheryl and Laura Dern as Cheryl's mother, Bobby. Cheryl's books have been translated into 40 languages. Her essays have been published in the Best American Essays, the New York Times, the Washington Post magazine, Vogue, and Salon, among others. In addition to her writing, she somehow finds time to offer radical empathy and advice for the lost, lonely, and heartsick in the popular WBUR-FM podcast, Dear Sugar Radio, along with Steve Arnold, her co-host. Cheryl holds an MFA in fiction writing from Syracuse University and a bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota. She lives in Portland, Oregon, with her two children and her husband, documentary filmmaker Brian Lindstrom. Please join me in welcoming Cheryl Strayed.
Hi, everyone. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight, and thank you, UNO, for inviting me. And Jelan and Paul Brown, I just can't even express enough how honored I am. There you are. To be really honoring the legacy of your mother, Marion Brown, it really means so much to me. My heroes are writers, and your mother, Paul, is among them. I mean, to think about any writer publishing that many books, but really to be a woman writer back in those days doing that, you know, was really a trailblazing thing to do. So thank you for including me here tonight. It is true that writers were my first heroes. I, from the age of 6, when I first learned how to read, felt something different, something bigger, when I would read books, or, you know, when I would come to that kind of beauty on the page that writers can make. It's been an exceptional guiding light through my whole life. I remember the first time, I really is like the first epiphany that I had, when I was just like 6. I had spent the night at a friend's house, and my family didn't attend church, but my friend's family did. So I'd spent the night a Saturday night. We woke up the next morning, and I was taken to church with her family. It was this Lutheran church in Chaska, Minnesota. Does anyone know where Chaska, Minnesota is? All right. It's about an hour outside the Twin Cities. I lived there when I was like ages like 6 to 12. And, you know, so here we are, sent to this little Sunday school, and the Sunday school teacher passed out this little sort of chapbook. It was the 70s. It was these, you know, watercolors and pretty pictures of butterflies and birds and rainbows and such. And opposing each picture was just a little poem, a few lines. And it really was that kind of epiphany moment for me, because I saw, you know, I thought the pictures were fine and everything, but those words, what those few words on a page could do to me, I was nothing short of pierced. And I thought, I want to be this person. This is what I want to be. This is what I want to give the world. I want to make somebody feel that kind of emotion, that kind of understanding, that kind of beauty. And I didn't know, you know, the 48-year-old looking back, remembering that 6-year-old that I was, I'm, of course, making it so much more cogent and articulate than it was. You know, at the time, what I can tell you is that I was a 6-year-old who felt really driven to do something with language, but didn't see the path, didn't see how that would, you know, would come to pass. I didn't know really what an author was. They all, I thought, was, you know, sort of people who lived a long time ago. But I wasn't living at the time in a house full of books, or I didn't have a family that said, oh, you're interested in this, let's take you and do that. It was really kind of up to me to find my way. At the time when I was 6, my mom was a single mom. She had 3 kids under the age of like 9 or 10. She had finally escaped a marriage with my father that was violent and abusive and really difficult. And we were poor. We lived in this apartment building, as I wrote in Wild, you know, it was kind of built for, we lived in these series of apartment buildings that were built for single moms and their kids. And they always had these really grandiose names like Barbary Knoll and Lake Grace Manor. And, but there was nothing mannerly about Lake Grace Manor, I'll just tell you that. And I was just a kid who read books. My mom, even though, you know, I was really at that age definitely marked by this father who wasn't the kind of father we hope anyone will have, I was also deeply marked by the mother who was the kind of mother that we all hope we have when we think about mothers, right? My mom loved me and my brother and sister full throttle. And, you know, against all kinds of difficulties and challenges and circumstances that were not ideal, my mom was, you know, a great mom. She always made me and my brothers and sister feel whole, even when parts of our lives had actually been fractured. I was, you know, always kind of, you know, had a sense of my mom as a hero. And when I think about all this writing I did, in Wild, about the power of walking, the power of putting one foot in front of the other, I really think that goes back to that kind of earliest metaphorical walk that my mom took when she made the brave decision to finally leave my dad after years of abuse. By the time I was a teenager, I was living in northern Minnesota. Now, some of you knew Chaska, but do any of you know McGregor, Minnesota? Somebody knows McGregor? Oh my gosh, okay. See, this is what I like about Nebraska. Nobody else has ever heard of McGregor, Minnesota. So by the time I was, 12 or 13, my mother had remarried my stepfather, and he is a carpenter still. He fell off a roof and broke his back. And as I said, we were poor, but because my stepfather broke his back, my parents got a $12,000 settlement. That's how much you get, apparently, if you break your back. And my mom said, this is the only time we're ever going to have any money. Let's buy land. Let's have a home that is our own. We'd always rented and lived here and there. And so we went to northern Minnesota, and my mom and stepdad bought 40 acres of land with their $12,000 in cash. And just in case you're interested, you can still buy 40 acres of land in northern Minnesota for $12,000. There's been absolutely no appreciation at all. It's bogs, it's woods. Our 40 acres are 20 miles away from the nearest town, which is McGregor, which has 400 people. And so we're really out there. And, it just, this collision, we don't have any, there's nothing on the land. We build our own little house out of trees that we mostly felled ourselves. We didn't have indoor plumbing. All through my whole high school, we did not have indoor plumbing. We didn't have electricity and running water for a time. And this is, northern Minnesota. And I would, of course, like any reasonable teenager, complain bitterly about this, about having to, the outhouse and wash my hair in a bucket that's heated over a wood stove and all that stuff. And my mom would always say what no teenager ever wants to hear, this is character building. You will thank me later, she would say. I mean, my mom's been dead so long, but I can still see exactly the look on my mom's face when she would say, this is character building, which would have always been me, rolling my eyes and sighing. But of course, later I would come to understand that she was right, that she built that experience in the wilderness built my character in such a way that it would be the thing that I would reach back to and call upon when I needed to save myself, when my mother was nowhere to be found. And so, while I'm living on this land, I'm this teenager, what I'm really thinking all this while is, I have to get out of here, I want to be a writer. And I felt really sure that I couldn't possibly be a writer in this little podunk place where nothing interesting happened. I didn't yet have a consciousness that, of course, all of our lives are interesting, and in fact, that place that I'm from is full of story and full of poetry, full of the lives that are worthy of literature. But I knew I needed to get out of there and get an education. I didn't know how. I didn't know there again. Didn't know what the path was. Had to do a little bushwhacking on my own to figure it out. And when I was a senior in high school, I started to think about college. And this wasn't, I didn't have the kind of family that my mom was like, let's go on college tours. Instead, what I did is I received brochures in the mail, just like, you do when you're a senior in high school, from different colleges. And I just put them all out on the kitchen table one day and studied those brochures very carefully. And I chose, I was under the impression you were to just pick one college and apply to it. So I chose the one college that had a brochure that featured the least weird-looking people. Which seems crazy and like something that can't possibly be true, but is true. That's exactly what I did. And it just so happened that this place, this not weird-looking brochure, so if any of you are like brochure makers or work in marketing, every once in a while, those pictures matter. So this was the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's a private Catholic college. Somebody's up there, St. Thomas? All right, right. So they accepted me. And they, in their acceptance letter, said one of the benefits, if you should decide to go here, they didn't realize they were the only game in town for me, is that your parents and grandparents can attend college full-time, as many classes as they want, for free. And I read this letter. My mother was, you know, standing over my shoulder, and I was like, you know, she just said, "Wow, I have always wanted to go to college." And I said, or at least I thought to myself, "There is no way in hell you're going with me." Would any of you guys like to bring your mom to college? Raise your hand if you would have signed up for that when you were 17. I really did not want my mom to go to college with me. Part of going to college, the point of going to college is to escape your mother, right? Don't tell my kids that. But, you know, it really is. And so what happened to me is what happens to me over and over and over again, and probably to a lot of you as well, is that, you know, there's that first truth, which is you don't want your mom to go to college with you when you're 17. The second truth was I knew, even then, how much my mother had sacrificed for me, how much my mother had given up her dreams and her life so that she could be a good mother and provide for me and my brother and sister. You know, she'd worked in factories, she'd worked as a waitress, she'd had a lot of interests that she couldn't pursue because it just, she had to always be, you know, mothering us and paying the bills. And I realized, you know, I can't stand in the way of my mom and this opportunity. So I told her, "You can go to school there." And mind you, this college is 3 hours south of where we were living. So my mom, I said, "You can go with me, but under one condition. If you should ever encounter me on this tiny campus, don't say hello. Don't look at me. Linger, you know, your gaze." And which I know is terrible now, but, you know, I was a teenager. And my mom understood, and she said, "Okay, that's the deal." So we had this deal. And so she would drive, you know, 3 hours down to the Twin Cities, go to school. She took full-time. And we both, our worlds opened up. And some of you in the room maybe are students here. Let's hear it. How many of you are students here? All right. So I know some of you maybe are relating to maybe not bringing your mom to college, but do any of you have your mom at college with you? But to this experience that I had that year, and that my mom had too, which was like, you know, the whole world opening up, and suddenly I could see a path to my dream. I could see a path to becoming an author. I had professors who actually wrote books, and professors who loved books and talked to me deeply about them. And it was really a revelation, and it was a revelation for my mom as well. I was paying for my own college education, taking out student loans, which, just for the record, I finished paying off on my 44th birthday. If you bought a copy of Wild in the first year that it came out, you helped me make those final payments. I get about $1 a book, so thank you. It was my birthday present to myself on my 44th birthday. So I said to my mom, you know, this private school, I just can't afford it. So at the end of this freshman year, I said to my mom, "I'm going to have to transfer to the University of Minnesota." And she said, "That is fine, honey. I will also transfer." And so she did. Thank goodness there's more than one campus. So she went to the University of Minnesota in Duluth, and I went to the one in the Twin Cities. And we're going to school at the same time. We're, you know, competing, had competitive GPAs, and, you know, really turning right along. And in our senior year, right around Christmas of our senior year of college, my mom got what she thought was a bad cold. And it was just one of those colds that we get every once in a while, that it just lingers. You know, it's like the cough that wouldn't stop, and then the feeling of sort of unwellness that lingered. And my mother finally, went to the doctor and had a chest x-ray and found, much to all of our great surprise, that she had advanced stage lung cancer. And she was 45. They told her that she would probably live about a year, and she died 7 weeks later. She died 7 weeks to the day after she was told she had cancer. She died the Monday of our spring break of our senior year. My mom had two classes left to take. She was two classes shy of her bachelor's degree. And I was destroyed. One of the things I felt the day that my mom died was that I was completely alone in the whole world. And what's been probably the most rewarding and meaningful experience I've had as a writer who's written about my mother's death in ways that are fictional and Torch and nonfictional and Wild and in my work as Dear Sugar is that how deeply I have helped others feel not so alone and how deeply I have been told and informed that I'm not alone either, that there are so many people, I know some of you are in the room, who have come to me and said, you wrote what I feel. I know what that kind of loss feels like. I know what it feels like to lose somebody so essential that you actually feel like you can't live without them, that you really can't go on, that life as you know it is over. And that's how I felt the day my mom died. I was, a senior in college. I was also going about the business of trying to become a young woman. And the woman that my mother was, because she was such a great mom, it's the thing that always also made it for me, kind of, at least till that point in my life, that okay that I had this absent father who, when he was present, was a really destructive, violent, abusive force in my life. You know, my mom was so big that she covered that wound, that father wound. And then when my mom was gone, the whole thing was just there. And there was me. I did the things that, we do when we're in pain. I tried really hard to be the good, noble daughter and to honor my mom and to, in some ways, take her place in my family. And I pretty quickly that became apparent that it was just like that was unsustainable and impossible. So my family disintegrated. And still to this day, it did. We never got that back. And so there was really this sense, when I say life as I knew it ended when my mom died, it was true that it did. And so I had to figure out how to go forward. And I turned my sorrow inward. As I wrote in Wild, I started to become wildly promiscuous in ways that were really destructive. I met a man who was using heroin and introduced me to heroin. And I tried it and thought, wow, this is the one thing that's offering me some sense of relief from this pain. And of course, that only led me into deeper pain, as we know, right? That people turn to those things that are often the things that then take them deeper rather than lift them up. And, the older me, the me in my 40s, years later when I was writing Wild, and looking back at my younger self, I mean, one of the most glorious gifts of being a writer. Some people would not, think this is glorious, but I'm the sort of person who does think it's glorious, is that you get to really look very deeply at your life. You don't get to just say, well, I was an idiot, I was a knucklehead, who knows what I was thinking. When I was writing Wild, what I had to do is actually interrogate who I was and what I was thinking and why I did the things I did. And I can tell you that the reason that I was self-destructing is because I loved my mom and I wanted to honor her. I wanted the world to notice that this extraordinary woman was no longer here. And the world really wasn't going to notice. My mom, as extraordinary as she was to me and my brother and sister, was ordinary. I mean, the only time she even was in the newspaper was her obituary in all her life. And so, my kind of early 20s self was saying, okay, I'm going to destroy myself to prove to you all how much my mom was to me. And about 3.5 years into, my grief after my mother died, I kind of had that sort of awakening moment or that rock bottom moment or however you want to phrase that moment where I realized that I was actually doing the wrong thing. That the only way to honor my mother would be to become the woman she raised me to be, to make good on all of that investment in love that she'd given me, to make good upon the ambition that I had the luxury, because of her, to pursue, to be that person who was a writer and who brought beauty and truth and connection into the world through words and story. That's a pretty hard realization to have when I could see suddenly what was the truest thing at the lowest, weakest moment of my life. And it was just about then that I happened to be, you know, right around this era, I was in an REI store, and I was waiting to pay for a foldable shovel. One of the great things about real life is when you write about real life is, you know, real life hands you like metaphors. I had to dig my truck out because there was a blizzard in Minnesota, like there are often blizzards in Minnesota. And here I really needed to dig myself out. And as I was standing in line waiting to pay for this book, I saw this, to pay for this shovel, I saw this guidebook. It was called The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California. And I picked it up. I'd never heard of the Pacific Crest Trail. And I turned over and read the back, and there was this paragraph that described this national scenic trail that went from Mexico to Canada through California, Oregon, and Washington, up the Sierra Nevada and the Cascade Range. And it's just there. It belongs to all of us. It's a wilderness corridor. All you have to do to be part of something that grand and big is to step onto it and take another step. And I was sort of thunderstruck by the idea of it. And I had this feeling inside of me that just blossomed. I was like, I have to do this. This is the thing I have to do. I thought in some ways if I could attach myself to it, that I could find my way back to my strength, and not to become a different person, but really to return to the person I was. So I set about doing that. I, you know, as those of you who've read Wild, how many of you have read Wild? Oh my gosh, thank you. So, you know, I saved up my money and I got myself, you know, all of these things from REI. And, you know, here's the thing. I had grown up in the wilderness. I loved to hike. I had never, though, gone backpacking. But I sort of blurred that over in my mind. I kind of do this a lot in my life where you're like, you know, oh, okay, you know, I can walk. I can, you know, and then that becomes like this 1,100-mile trek in the wilderness by myself. And then it was only that, you know, so I get all this stuff, you know, I shut down my life in Minneapolis. I drive to Mojave, California, this little town near the PCT. And I am alone. I check into this motel room that costs $18 for the night. Those of you who've seen the movie, how many of you have seen the movie? Awesome. So those of you who saw the movie, most of it was shot in Oregon where I live. We only shot one day in California. And the day we shot in California was the day that Reese, pretending to be me, hikes, you know, the first steps on the Pacific Crest Trail. So when you see, you know, her signing that register, that's the register I signed. She's in the exact same spot I was. When you see her on the side of the roads trying to put on that backpack, that's exactly where I was. And it was really moving, you know. But so I'm in this little town a long time ago before I had any notion that Reese Witherspoon would someday play me. And I'm so broke that, you know, the room is 18 bucks. And I'm there with all this stuff. And I put it in the backpack. And I put it in the backpack for the first time, you know. Wild, FYI, is not a how-to book. It's a Can You Believe I Did This book. And I put all this stuff in my pack. And I realized, oh, I'm in the Mojave Desert where it turns out there's, like, no water. Another FYI, that I had to carry like 24 and a half pounds of water in this big, terrible, floppy dromedary bag. When I went to get, I had all this stuff in my pack and I went to lift it, I could not lift it. Like I really profoundly could not lift it. It was heavier than anything that I could lift. And it was also the thing I had to carry through 1,100 miles of wilderness. And, you know, one of the most common questions I get about Wild is, why did you take so long to write it? Why did you wait? This hike was in the summer of 1995, long time ago. It was the summer of the O.J. Simpson trial. It was the summer before any of us knew what a cell phone was, and most of us didn't know what the internet was. It was, you know, a different kind of time, and, you know, many years ago in my life. And the answer to that question is that, you know, I didn't wait. I wrote Wild at the moment that I had something to say about the hike. And I think this is one of the most important things to understand about the art and craft of memoir, and maybe, you know, both as a writer and a reader, and that is, like, you know, that it's the point of Wild isn't, I'm so interesting because I have suffered more and loved my mother more than anyone else did, or I have taken a sort of wilderness trek or made it a physical you know, accomplishment that's greater than others. None of those things are true. And, you know, before I was writing Wild, in all those years that I thought, yeah, it was an interesting, meaningful, important experience, but what do I have to say about it? And as a writer, until you know what you have to say about something in a way that transcends your own kind of interesting life, you don't really have a book. You don't really have the power to make that claim on other people's attention. But when I wrote that scene, which in the book is quite comic, in the movie it's quite comic, you laugh at the knuckleheaded kid that I was with this really ridiculously heavy pack, and that she can't lift it, and she's, you know, wrestling with it and being crunched underneath it. It's kind of like almost a slapstick scene. When I wrote it, I didn't know I was writing a book at that point. I thought I was just kind of feeling my way into the story. But when I wrote it, I understood that in so many ways, this was the heart of the book, and it was the core of the book, and it was certainly the thing that illuminated for me what I had to say and why I had to say it. And what it was is that it wasn't, you know, when I say I was in this room with a backpack I couldn't, that was a weight I couldn't bear, and I had to bear it. I knew that I was speaking not just about the physical experience of that pack, but also about what was true about me emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, that I had to bear what I could not bear. I could not live without my mother, and I had to. And as soon as I saw that there was that deeper truth, I understood that it was not just a story about me. It was a story about all of you, all the people in those 40 languages who have read Wild. One of the most moving things to me is they all say the same things to me about the book. Not one culture or generation or gender says something different to me about what Wild means to them. And I think that when you tap into that, what you're tapping into, it's really what every writer is trying to do, is the human experience. What does it mean to be us? What does it mean to be human? That is the question that literature and art really undertakes to answer. And that's why when, you know, your professor assigns you Shakespeare and you're like, why am I reading this ridiculous thing that was written all these hundreds of years ago, and then you find yourself reading it and saying, wow, how does this guy know what I know? How does this guy know what's in my heart? And that's the power of literature and art. You know, that's what we're trying to do when we say something to say, is about how do we connect with human experience. And I know all of you have had to bear something you can't bear. You know, or at least you thought. You know, sometimes it's a really small thing. It's like your first breakup with a boyfriend or girlfriend, and then like 2 weeks later, you're like, yeehaw, on to the next one. But at the time, you thought, I can't live without him. And then some of them are lifelong, right? Some of them are lifelong. And I think that is why so many people responded to Wild. It was not that I was interesting. It was that they saw their struggle, their truth, their mistakes, their victories in me. So I put on the backpack. As those of you who've read the book, for those of you who haven't read the book, spoiler, I survived.
You know, I put on my backpack. I could not lift it, but I managed to. I couldn't stand up beneath its weight, but I got myself out the door. And I really had the most kind of unexpected challenge. You know, I went out there thinking, again, imagining a kind of extended day hike, and then ended up being, you know, it was just so much harder than I thought it would be. The first 8 days of my hike, I didn't even see another human being. It was just me and that ridiculously heavy pack that scorched, you know, really wore my skin away. Everywhere it made contact, my feet were incredibly messed up because my boots didn't quite fit right. And, you know, even if your boots do fit right, if you're walking 20 miles a day up and down mountains day after day, you know, your feet almost always are punished extremely. I lost 6 toenails, you know, in the course of my hike, which is quite a painful experience. And, you know, all through this physical agony and challenge, you know, at the very beginning, I thought, well, you know, this trip was a really bad idea. I came out here to be spiritually rejuvenated. I came out here to reflect upon sunsets and feel, you know, healed in a kind of like Hallmark Channel kind of violins playing in the background way. And instead, I didn't even think about that stuff. For the first time in a long time, I wasn't engaged in my emotional life. I was engaged in the body, the struggle of the body. How do I survive this? How do I get water? How do I feed myself? How do I stay warm? How do I stay cool? Where do I sleep? And what turned out happening is I realized that that was exactly what I needed to do to heal. Because the way that you live without your mother, or fill in the blank, whatever it is you've had to live with, is that you just keep going forward. There was something so true and irrefutable about that physical experience of simply saying, I'm going to take another step, even if it hurts. And, you know, it was in so many ways when I was writing Wild, I looked back, I reflected upon, you know, what is the meaning of that experience? And I realized, like, again, how much, you know, I had concocted it myself. It was my way of saving myself. But it's really the way we've saved ourselves throughout time. Cultures across the world and have done things with their youth that I basically made for myself, and that is a rite of passage, to push yourself outside the comfort zone, to do something that's physically challenging, to do it alone, to be fully responsible for the consequences of all of your decisions, is a powerful experience. We never forget the things we learned the hard way. And I felt sad when I was writing Wild that we've sort of forgotten to do that as a culture. Imagine if we gave every young person that passage. Imagine if we middle-aged people had to go do that at the Four Seasons in Paris. That would be fun, wouldn't it? No, I mean, I really do think that we need that. And that's what I did on the PCT. I got myself to... if you want to know all the stuff that happened in between, you have to read the book, the people who didn't read the book. But, you know, I got myself through that hike. I wasn't the fastest hiker. I wasn't the best backpacker. I wasn't, you know, I didn't do anything perfectly. But guess what? I did it. And when I got to the Bridge of the Gods, which is this beautiful bridge that spans the Columbia River, forming the border between Oregon and Washington, have any of you been at the Bridge of the Gods in Cascade Locks? All right. I touched that bridge, and I looked around. I looked down at that grand American river, you know, that Lewis and Clark went down and so many people before me, and I just felt grateful. I felt not, you know, like, now I'm this victorious person who is like the Buddha, you know. I didn't start off, you know, Charles Manson and end up the Buddha, you know. And I know that that's a sort of tale we hear in Hollywood, but when I was writing Wild, I really wanted to write a story of real transformation. Because most of us, when we've had to change our lives, you know, all we do is it's actually a very subtle move. It's us coming from our weakness, to us coming from our strength. It's us focusing on the darkness or us reaching for the light. And that's the shift I made in my PCT hike. I finished it and I thought, okay, I can do this. I am not going to be cured of my grief. I'm never going to get to go back in time and have the dad I wish I'd had. I'm never going to get my mom back. I'm never going to have that family of origin be the happy story that I wanted it to be. But I can carry all that. I can carry all that. And that was an enormous change in my life. So when I was standing there, I went and just got an ice cream cone. People, since the book came out and the movie, people have been like, well, but why didn't you, go touch the river or lay down? And I'm like, because I didn't know there was going to be a movie starring Reese Witherspoon one day. I would have made it more cinematic. I just wanted ice cream. And that is, I have to say, the most surreal experience. Like, the fact that so many people know about my hike, and the thing that makes me so pleased is that people know my mom, Bobby. My ordinary mother, who was never written in the paper until she died, is known around the world because I did what she raised me to do, right? I made good on that. I did bring her in some way back into my life by bringing her into the world through my work. And that absolutely astounds me. I would have never imagined that. But, that's the thing about when you set about, making good in your dreams, is you don't know how that's going to end up down there. You just know, again, that keeping faith with a step. The three common questions, why'd you wait to write Wild? I already answered it. Did your toenails grow back? Yes, they did. The third question I get a lot is, what is the message of Wild? And to me, what I really want to tell you honestly is I never, when I was writing the book, it never occurred to me in anything I've ever written to have a message. I really believe that the book belongs to the people who love it. It belongs to the people that hate it too, but they usually just throw it out the window. So whoever picks it up on the sidewalk, it belongs to them. So for me, I'm always like, well, what is, I don't know. I wrote the story. I tried really hard to tell as much of the truth as I could bear, to reveal as much of myself, even the parts of myself that didn't look so good. And then the message is up to you. And one of the coolest things is it's been given back to me in waves and waves by the stories that you all tell me about what you found in the book about yourselves. And that is when we say art saves lives or there's the power in art, that's what the power of art is. And I will say, though, that, I think most powerfully for me has been, seeing the ways that hike in my life, not necessarily what I wrote in the book, but how it's lived in my life, has been made manifest in my children. I have a daughter, Bobby, who's named after my mom. She's 11. If you saw the movie, my daughter plays me. She's the little girl. She's the young Cheryl. She's a memory, as she says. Whenever Reese remembers her childhood, there's my Bobby playing me. And a son, Carver, who's going to be 13 on Saturday. And, Jillian asked me earlier today, how has Wild impacted your parenting, your mothering? I'm just going to end with this little story because I do think that in some ways, not only has that hike impacted my parenting, but it also in some ways has been for me a reminder from my kids of how I have to kind of continually re-engage with the things that I learned from that hike. And that is my kids, a few years ago when they were 8 and 9, we went to Chamonix, France. I taught a couple of summers there, a writing workshop. And the very first time we went there, they were 8 and 9. And I don't know if any of you, who's been to Chamonix? All right. I recommend it over McGregor, Minnesota. It's in the French Alps. It's where Switzerland and France and Italy come together. And it's just it's Mont Blanc. It's absolutely amazing. It's this little village. And, what you do there in the winter is you ski, and what you do there in the summer is you hike, or so I thought. When we pulled into town, I was excited about hiking. And my kids were looking upward at the sky at these little teeny tiny dots all in the sky, this blue sky with these white peaks. And my kids said, "What is that?" And I was like, "Oh, those are paragliders. You know, they're these crazy people who jump off of mountains on with kites attached to them, and they're flying." And both of my kids said, "I want to do that. Let's do that." And they, you know, they were 8 and 9, and both my husband and I were like, "There's absolutely no way you're doing that." Because you're 8 and 9 and you're not allowed to jump off a mountain with a kite and die. And they were, you know, all week we're seeing all these paragliders, and they land in this little meadow in the village, and all over the village there's, you know, there's this guy walking around saying, "Oh, do you want to, you know, want to go paragliding?" And my kids just kept up this campaign that they had to go paragliding. And I kept saying, "No, no, 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 no." And then finally, you know, I sort of broke. And I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to blame it on the paraglider place. I had this grand idea. And I said to my kids, "Okay, you can go, but ask them how old you have to be, because I think you probably aren't old enough." Because, of course, like, what reasonable, right? I mean, so my kids walk up to this Frenchman, and my daughter's like, "How old do you have to be to jump off a mountain and die?" And he says, 8. Only in France, okay? Never, I mean, it's crazy, okay? They're like, "You have to be 8 years old to be strapped to a Frenchman and a kite and run off the side of a mountain." So, of course, they come back to me, "Yeah, we're 8. Yeah, we can do it." And I was like, "Okay, you can't do this. You know, it would be, you know how I would be so roundly condemned, right? Like if something went wrong, and also you would die, which would be a bummer. And, you know, you just can't do this." And so I said to my kids, look, you know, here's the deal. You can't do it because actually you don't want to. You just think you want to. You're looking at this. It looks fun, you know, but what's going to happen is I'm going to pay all this money, and you're going to get up there." And the way it works is you pay the money, and then you send your kids up this, like, gondola that goes up this steep mountain with a Frenchman, and then they strap your kid on, or the person on, usually adults do it, and then the person in the front, you know, has to actually run off the side of the mountain and just, like, jump into the air. And then it's like a half hour of, like, flying around before you land. And so I describe this to my kids, and I say, "I know what's going to happen. I know that I will pay this money, and then you'll get up there, and you're gonna be too afraid to do it. You're gonna be like, I can't run and jump into the sky, and you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to waste my money, and like, let's just not go through that." And my son, who's 9 at the time, looked at me and said, "Mom, you're right. I am afraid, but I don't want to be a person who doesn't do things just because he's scared." Can you believe that? That's the message of WILD. And I saw that. I was like, "Oh, that's how, you know, how did he get that message? I don't want to be a person who doesn't do things just because he's scared." And I don't want to be that person either. And I don't want you guys to be that person, because I really think that all of the best things that happened to us, we did them even though we were scared, right? We didn't decide to let fear, as I wrote in WILD, be our ruler, you know? Does fear get to decide that thing that we do or not? So, of course, my son had me. I shelled over the money to the French guys. They went up the gondola. My husband and I stood in a field in the middle of Chamonix waiting for our children. It was torturous. It was like forever. They were specks in the sky. We couldn't even see them. And then finally they come circling down and down and down. And pretty soon they're close enough that they can see us and we can see them. And they start yelling, "Mom, Dad," and they land and they are alive. And it was this moment where they had, you know, that look on their faces that you can only get one way. And that is when you've done something yourself that was hard to do. And I really feel like that was the gift I gave myself by opting to take that hike. And to answer your question, Jillian, I hope that that's the gift that I've given my kids through my parenting of them, but really to so many people who've taken WILD into their hearts. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've got a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
So you have this book, and it's a bestseller. How does it become a movie? What's that process?
Okay, how does it become a movie? Okay, so, you know, it's funny, because almost everything that happened that was, like, super crazy, glamorous, and glorious, and good, happened so much more, kind of, in such a more ordinary fashion than you would believe. Like, for example, Oprah. How does Oprah happen? Oprah reads your book and likes it. Like it was literally that direct. Like, she... I was interviewed in O Magazine, and I'll answer your question about the movie in a minute, but like I was interviewed in O Magazine, and Oprah reads her own magazine, and she was like, oh, that book sounds interesting, and so she read it, and then she called up the reporter who had interviewed me for the magazine. She said, what's Cheryl Strayed's cell phone number? And she called me.
Oprah called you.
Oprah called me.
When Oprah calls you, does it come up Oprah on your
phone? Okay. Okay. You guys, this is so crazy and true. Okay, so I, Wild had been out like a month at this point. I was in Milwaukee. I was on my book tour, and I was in Milwaukee, and I was going to give a reading that night. And this sales rep from Chicago who was going to like pick me up and bring me to the reading, and he and this number appears on my cell phone like at noon on the day of the reading, and I see it's a Chicago. It says Chicago. It says, you know, doesn't say Oprah. It just says Chicago, And I thought, oh, it's a sales rep. He's just telling me what time he's going to pick me up. I'll let it go to voicemail. And then I thought, you know, it'll just be easier if I just deal with him. So I click, hi, this is Cheryl. Hi, this is Oprah. And I pause and I go, it is. Because when Oprah calls you, you recognize her voice.
Probably.
I mean, you know it. And she's like, I am sitting here. I have just finished reading your book, Cheryl. Oh, I love this book. And I was like, thank you. And then I said all kinds of swear words to her. And then she said, I have this idea, and I haven't talked to any of my people, and I haven't talked to any of your people. You and I are the only ones who know this right now. But, you know, I was thinking I could restart my book club for you. And I was like, I think that sounds like a good idea.
Absolutely.
Sounds great to me. And we're talking, and then she says, okay, now, when we get off the phone, you can, this is the other thing. So she's like, click, 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 and she's on my website, okay, which I still to this day just do myself, like this little homemade website. And she's like, I see that you're going to be in L.A. this weekend doing a reading. You're reading Saturday afternoon. Do you want to come to my house on Sunday? And I was like, okay. And so I went to Oprah's house that Sunday.
You did.
And I spent the day with her, and we've become, you know, great friends. And there are so many funny things. I mean, I could have done a whole night about Oprah. And I mean, because, so she invited me and my kids and my husband to her place in Maui, and we spent a week with her and Stedman. And it was amazing. I threatened my kids within like an inch of their lives about being like polite. And, you know, I was like, okay, we're going to Oprah's house. Like, what if my daughter, but my kids did all kinds of crazy, interesting things there. But they are lovely people, and Oprah is just such a champion for books and literature. I just admire her so much. But anyway, Reese, it was a similar kind of thing. It was just before Wild came out, I asked my agent, you think anyone in Hollywood would be interested in it? And my agent had heard that Reese was really looking for a strong role for herself, you know, a role that wasn't the cute sidekick. And we sent it to Reese. She read it within a couple days. And then I got a phone call saying, Reese really wants to talk to you about optioning the book. And so we got on the phone, and we just had a really deep, long conversation about books, about films, about women, about why she wanted to make this book into a movie. She vowed to me that she would honor it. And it began from there. It was just that it was a very direct, thing, you know, between the two of us.
So Oprah called you, and then Reese called you.
Yeah, it was the order was flipped. Reese called me, then Oprah called me.
Okay, I'm sorry, got it wrong. So when the movie's being made, are you hanging around the set?
Yeah.
Are you making sure that they're honoring the story?
Yeah. Yeah, I was deeply involved in it all, and really just bonded with all of the, you know, Laura Dern and Reese and Jean-Marc Vallée, the director, Nick Hornby, the screenwriter. They invited me into the process, and I, you know, obviously I cared about it, and I weighed in when I was asked and when it really mattered, but I also let it go. I wasn't a diva about it. Like, what I've always felt is the book is mine and the film is theirs. And of course I wanted the film to be something I was proud of, and I am. But I also knew it wasn't my film, you know. The book is my creation and the film is their creation.
When you start to write, and thank you for sharing that story, when you sit down to write, and I think all writers know this fear, and you look at the electronic paper or the real paper, and you have to get started, what pushes you? I know you've got all these stories in you, but what gets you started on writing a story?
Starting is, for me, the hardest thing by far. And I think that's true of most writers, and even people who aren't writers. You know, when you have to write something, don't you find it's that just getting started that's difficult? And, you know, so what I've come to realize is that, like, to invite that in, that anxiety in, to say, oh, this is a sign I'm going to write. I'm feeling anxious about writing. And just to say, this is part of the process. It's not an indicator that you shouldn't write. And it's just an indicator that beginning is hard. And so I try not to fret too much over how to begin. And what drives me is, you know, because I've thought about this question, because on my worst days, I'm like, look, I could just retire at this point. Like, I don't need to write another book, right? I mean, isn't Wild enough? I mean, please. I feel like, come on, I'm taking a break now, you know? I can't outdo that, is what I mean when I say, you know, like, I don't think I'll probably ever have another book that's, like, done what Wild did, you know, in terms of exposure. But what I realize is I don't need to. That's not why I write. I write because I have this internal kind of drive, like, to tell stories. And so I try to put myself in the service of that, even if I know that sometimes I'm going to fail at it and sometimes it's going to be difficult.
How do you fail at it? I mean, is that a story that you never complete? You don't
Well, or you spend a week writing and you're like, oh, that didn't really go anywhere. Or, you know, it could be too. Like, I always think, okay, my next book, which I'm working on now, again, I don't know if people are going to love it or not. You know, I don't know if it might come into the world and it's, you know, everyone says, oh, this was terrible. And then I'm like, okay, onward we go. I mean, but you can't write it to please people. You know, you have to, I mean, I don't, my idea of success and failure is not about what other people think of it, although it is really nice if people like it, and it's really painful if they don't. My measure of success or failure is, did I do the work, and did I do it as best as I could? And, you know, that's really true for me, and I try to remind myself when I'm writing.
I want to say thank you on behalf of Omaha, on behalf of UNO, for sharing your story, for being courageous enough to tell us what's going on deep inside of you, and for being here this evening. It's just been a wonderful, wonderful program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Cheryl Strayed, author of several books, including her best-selling memoir, Wild, as well as Tiny Beautiful Things, Brave Enough, and the novel Torch. Ms. Strayed's remarks were given as a second annual Marion Marsh Brown Writers' Lecture, presented annually by Marion's family, Paul and Jill Ann Brown, and their children, Randy, Scott, and Marietta Llewellyn. Marion Marsh Brown served as a professor of English at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, then Omaha University, from 1954 to 1968. She wrote more than 15 books and is best known for her young adult literature. The series celebrates her life and work by bringing a well-known author to UNO each year. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 27, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, Associate Director of Media Relations in the University of Nebraska at Omaha Office of University Communications, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.